Hello and welcome to The Leap of Faith. On tonight's programme, a journey from politics to pastoral work and the neglected role, according to one man, of prophecy in the Christian faith. But first, newly ordained as a priest in the Church of Ireland, former politician Trevor Sargent joins me in the studio this evening. He's been a TD for Dublin North, Minister of State for Food and Horticulture from 2007 to 2010, as well as the leader of the Green Party in the 6 years before that. Now he's a priest in the Church of Ireland Diocese of Cashel, Ferns and Ossory. Trevor, welcome to The Leap of Faith. You're recently ordained and that means you have a new boss.
Well, boss would be Jesus Christ. And that's some people, the Dean laughs at that sometimes when they say, who's your new boss? And to be honest, they're thinking of Eamon Ryan, as leader of the Green Party. And I'm saying, well, he is leader of the Green Party. It's true. And a great time for him. He's a good friend. But my boss is Jesus Christ. And that's where I take my reference point from.
What do your politician friends, I'm assuming you still have a few, make of your new title?
Well, I don't know. I haven't asked them all now. But there's no doubt I've had nothing but warmth and good wishes and very, very heartening support. At my ordination, I was delighted at that they were able to take the time. Eamon Ryan was there, John Gormley, Dan
John
Boyle.
Gormley coined a nickname for you.
Did he?
Trevor the Rev.
Thanks very much, John. John's a good friend. I have had many, many interesting conversations with John over the year, and had great fun. He's a good guy. I'm very fortunate to have met great people in politics, and that still continue to have good friends in politics.
I've heard it said that, particularly in Ireland, we love to put people in boxes and don't get out of your box sometimes. And what people are seeing now is you as an ordained minister and formerly as a government minister, and then they're seeing them separately. You don't actually see a distinction between those two parts of your life, or do you?
Well, not as much as maybe visibly it might indicate. I'm wearing a collar as an ordained priest, whereas as a government minister it would have been a shirt and a tie. So there's a difference. But when you strip it back, the nature of politics is to deal with people, and if you love dealing with people, then you will get satisfaction from politics. And it's very similar in terms of ministry. You're looking with people and working with people all the time. The difference is that it's probably a smaller group of people. If you compare a parish to a constituency, 60,000 compared to a few hundred, it means that you can get to know people a lot better in a kind of genuine way rather than in a kind of a superficial way. And, even though you'll get to know people well in a constituency, you can't know 60,000, in all honesty, even though some people might expect you to. And that can be an element of the unreasonableness.
There's so many comparisons we can draw. Mm. Your clinic can just as easily become, a pastoral session.
Oh,
in,
absolutely.
In the same idea.
In fact, much of the training, and the dean who I work with now, Dean Maria Johnson in Waterford Cathedral, would say that to me regularly, that there's no experience in your previous life that God will not make use of. And I can see huge similarities between politics and ministry that way.
Let's go back a little bit to you, maybe as a younger man, and your formation in your faith. I'm curious to know how that started for you.
Well, I was brought up in Temple Oak, South Dublin, as Church of Ireland baptised, and went to a local Church of Ireland school. So I suppose culturally I grew up in a Church of Ireland environment, in a community in which most of my friends were Roman Catholic, and that was never more than an interesting element of diversity. Yeah. So I didn't feel different in any sense. You might say I probably felt more different to some of my Church of Ireland colleagues north of the border. I didn't relate to the Orange Order. I didn't relate to any sense that I was under siege. I got that impression when I'd be visiting friends and relatives in the north.
I'm thinking too about you going through that process, going to school, and like any young fella growing up, was there a point at where your faith disappeared, dipped, waned, and headed off on a sabbatical?
Well, that's often the story of many people, and I hear that testimony quite often. And I'm not sure whether maybe I was just less adventurous than some of those rebels. But I always found it very important to me, my faith, you know, whether it was in school when I'd be going to 8 o'clock Holy Communion on a Sunday morning, so I'd have the rest of the day to study, which meant I was listening to the older language that tended to be the language used in the 8 o'clock service in the morning, or whether it be in teaching, where I was always in a Church of Ireland school, even though I was involved in setting up a Gael school and very involved with Educate Together schools and other schools as well. And that was important then too. And then in politics, it was essential. I mean, especially in the early 90s when I was elected, the peace process was only really starting to come together. And it was very much, you know, sometimes one step forward, two steps backwards. So there was a huge amount of doubt. And, you know, few of us in the Dáil who had a strong Christian faith from different backgrounds, I have to say, were moved to set up a prayer breakfast. And that provided not just a way of praying and asking God to assist in the difficult work of forming peace after such a long conflict, but there was also an opportunity to meet like-minded Christians from other jurisdictions, whether it be Northern Ireland or Britain or South Africa or America, where similar prayer breakfasts were taking place in their respective parliaments and assemblies. And they were neutral meeting grounds, you might say. In a way, I mean, the central and common theme was that God ultimately was in charge, and we were doing our best to try and interpret and be empowered by the Holy Spirit.
Looking back over that period of time, is there anything comes to mind for you where you had to bear witness as a Christian to something, where you had to stand up and be heard as a Christian rather than a politician, or even as a politician?
I didn't really divide them in my head, you know. My political work was part of a vocation that I felt God had called me to. So to that extent, I was prepared to, as they say, speak truth to power, or whatever that term might be. Do you know, most of the time, I have to say that when I would be espousing long-term interests, as green politics tends to involve itself with, looking to the concerns of those that were disenfranchised or the poor or the children or grandchildren when it comes to the likes of climate change. That for me was trying to speak a Christian perspective into what wasn't politically popular. You know, one could be accused of all sorts of things if one was making those points that were to the disadvantage of the status quo. And, you know, that was politically unpopular. And that for me was a way that God was saying, I know this mightn't be popular, but you've got to say it.
I mean, an atheist or agnostic politician could just simply say they had a moral compass that directed them towards a decision. But you have something in addition to that, in that you are following a prescribed faith.
Well, yes. I mean, the Anglican Communion has five points of mission. And the fifth one is very specifically one that I would have lived by, along with the other four, hopefully, as well. But there are, as you can imagine, you know, proclaiming the gospel, teaching, baptizing, transforming unjust structures in society. And the fifth one that was added in 1990 was to safeguard the integrity of creation and to renew the life of the earth. And so that for me, as part of a mark of mission,
written for you,
was really, and that's what I did my master's thesis on, was the development of that and how it's been interpreted and or ignored, as the case may be.
So what is the role then for church or faith in ecology?
Very central. It is ultimately the missional role. If one reads the Psalms and you hear and often read about how the glory of God is in creation and how, you know, God is a God of every living thing, you know, not just certain people or not even just humans or whatever. There is an awesome universality about God's persona. And the only way really to come to terms with that is to investigate and learn more about creation and to appreciate the huge complexity of it, the fact that we know very little about it. It has a humbling experience. And I think One thing that hopefully, and this sounds kind of a paradox to claim that one is humble, because that's not what you do when you're humble. But all the same, humility is the first step, I think, into coming into a relationship with God. Because if you have a difficulty in accepting humility, then one is putting oneself in the place of God.
That does get confused by people who are desperately trying to build up people's self-esteem and self-worth.
Mm.
And then at the other hand, you're coming back and saying, well, you've got to be humble.
Well, the self-esteem part to me is about being cherished and recognizing that you're a valuable part of God's creation, and that God has created you specifically with all sorts of plans and hopes and dreams. And to cherish that and to value that and to be buoyed up and empowered by that is a very important part of one's whole character.
It's unavoidable in this conversation with you to look for parallels, but I'm thinking of the idea that when you come to ecology, for example, and religion, people sometimes just dabble rather than commit.
Mm.
We make small gestures towards the recycle bin or some of those things. You know, where's the thrust in that to do more?
Yeah. Knowing what has to be done is the first point, and it's a huge amount. I mean, President Michael D. Higgins was speaking about it in his inauguration speech when it comes to climate change and the challenges. And in fact, we're going in the opposite direction to the direction we should be going in some cases, in terms of energy consumption, for example. So once one appreciates the scale, then there's no room really for dabbling, unless one is just trying to distract.
Well, I mean, I put it as a question to you. Can you make your parish where you are, can you make it more environmentally friendly?
Step by step, yeah. And I guess that's the empowering thing that needs to be done, is to take bite-sized progress and, you know, accumulate them and one step after a time build up a more sustainable outlook and a more sustainable society. But you see, this is where we start going into the area that why faith is so important, because all of those steps that we take are very difficult to do enough. That's the point. And it is at a point, if one reads the Bible, where there were efforts made, you know, whether it be the Israelites coming out of Egypt and in the desert, and Moses tearing his hair out at the frustrations. But ultimately, there comes a point where there's a transformative gear change. And that, to me, is when miracles happen. That's a way of defining miracles to me, when you seem to be just going along a plane for a long time, getting nowhere. And then all of a sudden, there's a step. And so I think if one is conscious of the need of what needs to be done, does everything possible, and then things start to happen. And that's where I think prayer comes into it.
One of the things I'm often curious about is that when people pray and, you know, and they're in that conversation, and ask you this directly, what's your tone of voice when you talk and pray to Jesus?
It's more of a listening than a speaking, to be honest. I mean, I know that Jesus already knows what I'm going to pray anyway. So I might speak for my own clarification purposes, but ultimately I listen, and hopefully that still small voice, gets through all of the other noises that are in my head.
Reverend Trevor Sargent, thank you for joining us on The Leap of Faith.
It's a pleasure.
From prayer to prophecy, and to our next guest this evening. Father Pat Collins is a Vincentian priest. He helped establish the Alpha Course in Ireland, teaching the basics of the Christian faith through evangelization, and is the author of several books, including his latest entitled Prophecy. Father Pat, welcome to The Leap of Faith. Before we get into the details, what's your definition of prophecy?
The word literally means to speak on behalf of. So a prophet's like an ambassador, mediating a message on somebody else's behalf. And in this case, it's a message that's coming directly from God. And one of the things that people often don't appreciate about prophecy, it's not involving your knowledge, it's not involving your intelligence or your experience. So it's unique, it's directly from God. And there's a lovely saying which comes from one of the fathers of the church. When the prophet speaks, he or she remains silent. In the sense, there's nothing of them in the message they're relaying to the other people.
Now, the creed, as if it's said on a Sunday morning, I believe in the Holy Spirit who spoke through the prophets. So it is actually a fundamental requirement for somebody who's following a Christian faith to have room for the concept of prophecy.
Oh, and I would say one of the reasons I wrote the book on prophecy was because I think it's totally neglected in the church. And I'm wondering, why do they neglect it? Because it's so obviously important. The key people to me in the Old Testament are the wonderful prophets. They seem, you know, almost magical to me that they're getting these messages from God about the present and the future. And they turn out to be so accurate. And that people even today can get prophetic messages.
But if you profess that you have received information from an outside source in the modern world, you may be referred to a psychiatrist.
That is true. And there is a problem in Western culture at the moment. Since the Enlightenment, the presumption is that God can't communicate directly with human beings. And therefore, it's just assumed you can't say that you got a message from God. That's just not possible. Of course, my point is, it is possible, and I think it's essential for Christianity that we believe that we have direct communication with God.
Well, you did mention the idea that it's somewhat neglected. Is it very possible that this neglect comes through almost maybe a little bit of an embarrassment about the idea that we're now a sophisticated race? Here we are in, you know, this stage of our development, that we don't need to go back to a principle of an unknown voice.
Well, that is the modern assumption, that everything now is better than it used to be. But look at Christianity. It's declining rapidly in the Western world as we live on that basis. And it is almost a de-supernaturalized version of Christianity, the liberal model. And I think until we restore the supernatural and the prophetic, Christianity will continue to decline. And there is a psalm that says, "Unless the Lord build the house, in vain do the laborers build." Now, I think there's far too much human effort in Christianity at the moment, and going on the basis of human knowledge and human planning. I'm not against those things, but they're not enough. We need the prophetic as well, coming directly from God.
Well, you've used the word. Let's explore it a little bit further, which is the room for supernatural in Christianity. What do you define as the supernatural part of
well,
the faith?
The liberal version will strip out most of the supernatural elements. So there'll be very little belief in angels or evil spirits. There will be very little emphasis on things like getting revelation in dreams or visions or healings that are supernatural or miracles that are supernatural. All that is stripped out. It's all mythological.
So people communicate with God in one direction through prayer, not necessarily expecting an answer back. Who are the chosen ones that get the prophecy?
All Christians should be, because, I believe this so passionately, and that the church is dying again because we talk far too much and listen far too little. And so the prophet Samuel's words, "Speak, Lord, your servant is listening," to me is the vital part of prayer. And that when I pray, yes, I do tell God how I feel and what I need and all that. But then I shut up and I say, "Now, have you anything to say to me?" And I believe passionately God does speak to us, and he speaks to me. Of course, you need discernment. Is it truly from God, or is it coming from your human nature, or maybe even the evil one? But I do believe God speaks to us.
Does it bring you comfort or fear when you hear a prophecy or a voice?
Oh, it gives me an enormous sense of comfort in that I feel the God I love is close to me and speaking to me. And when I read about Jesus, he'll often say, "I don't say a word myself. It's the Father who told me what to say. It's the Father who told me what to do." And I think a Christian is somebody who is so united to Christ that he's speaking to their hearts through the Holy Spirit and instructing them what to say and what to do, ideally.
The Catholic Church would issue guidelines for people not to become involved with mediums, spirituality, talking to spirits. How do you distinguish that from prophecy?
Oh, it's a very good question. And that's exactly what's happening, that in the absence of the genuine article, real prophecy from God, people are resorting to occult means and divination, which is really where we're going to get knowledge and control things ourselves rather than relying on God. So the tragedy is that when people get involved in the occult way of getting information, often they're dialoguing with evil spirits, and they're the ones that come along then looking for deliverance and for exorcism because they've opened themselves to the dark side. They don't mean any harm, but the world of the spirit is dark and light. And as Bob Dylan said once, you've got to serve somebody. It may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you've got to serve someone, and there's no neutral ground.
Do you find yourself having to defend your work as an official, for example? Exorcist would be the phrase that I think would be used to define you.
Yes, I do, although I find that there's a morbid interest in exorcism and the dark side. And I think in a secular culture where the supernatural is being ruled out, you can't get rid of it completely. And what's residual is this morbid interest in the dark side. And it breaks my heart because I'm not all that interested in exorcism at all. I'm interested in healing, in prophecy and all these things. But people never talk to me about those. So I would much prefer that they would listen to the positive side of Christianity.
Well, you described earlier the engagement with this evil spirit is a healing process rather than an exorcism.
Well, certainly if there's an evil spirit impinging on somebody, that spirit will try and rob them of their true potential and their true dignity. And so I see it as intrinsic to evangelization that you deliver people. And it's very significant that when Jesus is commissioning the apostles at the end of Mark 16, he says, these are the signs of power that will be given to believers when you go out to preach the coming of the kingdom. Very first one, in my name, you will drive out evil spirits. You know, and when Jesus goes to the synagogue in Jerusalem, he says, I'm sent to bring the good news to the poor, to set free the captives. So my image of evangelization is setting people free. Free to be who they are, sons and daughters of God. And if these blooming spirits are impinging on them, then in the name of the Lord, we'll get rid of them so they can develop their potential.
But if we bring in Carl Jung or we bring in any of the psychologists and psychiatrists there, they might say that you're using the word spirit as a metaphor for a mental illness.
Carl Jung started off with that hypothesis that there were complexes and that they were really in the unconscious and that they were what we used to call evil spirits. But as he got older, he revised his opinion and he thought, no, there's an objective realm of darkness which is impinging on people. And he said, if you don't take it seriously, you won't liberate them.
Does the devil issue prophecies?
Yes, he can. You know, he can give false prophecies, and sometimes part of them will be true. And this is where discernment is so necessary. Where is my inspiration coming from, that revelation coming from?
My guest in the studio is Father Pat Collins, and we're talking about his book, Prophecy. Pat, with all of your experience of this across your years as a priest, have you unsettled any of your fellow priests?
Oh, I'm a cause of controversy all the time. And I don't want to be dramatic about it, but the phrase, the prophet is not accepted in his own country, comes to mind. I mean, I do get a lot of criticism. And, you know, I'd be arguing with the bishops and with colleagues about things.
Do they want you to tone it down a bit?
Yeah, and they would see me as a bit extreme. And I just have to be true to my heart and say, well, this is the way I see things.
It is interesting that prophets appear in practically all faiths and all religions.
Yeah, any genuine religion that's in touch with God will have to affirm the fact that God can communicate with us. Otherwise, we'd know nothing about God. We'd just know that God exists, and there'd be a kind of an unbridgeable gulf between us and God. But God comes into the human situation. Of course, that's uniquely true in Christianity, where God becomes a human and says, now, to see me is to see God, because I am the manifestation of the mind and the heart of God. And so every word that Jesus speaks is God speaking to us.
And yet sometimes the messages are not what we would expect. If they were coming from a divine source, they would be full of enlightenment and they would have the answers to all our problems.
Well, often God will say things that people don't want to hear. And that's why the prophets weren't accepted, because they were saying things that just didn't fit in with the mindset of the people. And it's no different nowadays. I don't think you'd be a genuine prophet unless you're getting a hard time.
Father Pat Collins, thank you for joining us on The Leap of Faith.
Thank you.
And that's The Leap of Faith for this week. You're very welcome to email the programme, faith@rte.ie. Join us next week when my guest will be the poet, author and broadcaster, Aidan Matthews. From all of us here tonight, good night.